I promise you, I've been planning this episode for a long time, much longer than the recent election of our new president. You see, there's a 50th anniversary coming up, a 50th anniversary of the ratification of an amendment to our Constitution that addresses an extremely important subject. It's the 25th Amendment to the Constitution. Do you know what that amendment does? Think about it a moment. It's been in the news lately, not because of its 50th anniversary, but because the 25th Amendment addresses what you do when the president dies or perhaps goes crazy. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and this week it's about the 25th Amendment.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
What do you do if the President of the United States dies? What do you do if he perhaps has a stroke, becomes disabled? What do you do if he simply begins behaving erratically, doing strange things that lead you to question his mental stability? Well, there's an app for that. It's called the 25th Amendment, and it's celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. It was ratified back in 1967. To discuss it with us, we've called the guy who literally wrote the book. His name is John Feerick, and his book was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. John, welcome to the show. Tell us what you do.
I'm a law professor at Fordham University Law School. I've been a professor here for, I guess, 40 years, if you include 6 years as an adjunct when I was a practicing attorney. I teach subjects involving the Constitution, legal ethics, conflict resolution, and I've done a clinic on the presidential succession system, which I've been currently involved in doing that clinic as well. I have students who do studies on the presidential succession system. I'm the firstborn of immigrant parents from Ireland and grew up in the Bronx and attended Fordham College and Fordham Law School and I'm currently 80 years of age and still trying to hack it, so to speak, at full-time teaching.
Well, that's because you have the best job in the world, and people just never want to retire from being law professors, do they?
Well, it's a wonderful job, and it's a wonderful community here at Fordham Law School in New York.
You're right in Manhattan, aren't you?
Correct, at Lincoln Center, and law school is in a new building, which is just a lovely building in Lincoln Center, and I'm very much involved in overseeing, so to speak, a social justice center that gets involved in a lot of projects involving poor people and low income earners, and as well as teach as I mentioned, and it keeps me quite busy.
And you used to be on the dark side, didn't you? You served as dean for a few years.
I was dean for 20 years, and and I forgot to mention that.
That's all right.
And also father of six children and 11 grandchildren.
Oh, my goodness. Well, among those many accomplishments, one that you've been too modest to mention is that you're also the recipient of a nomination for the Pulitzer Prize for a book on a subject that's actually been in the news a lot lately, and that's the 25th Amendment. That was quite an accomplishment, getting that nomination.
Well, thank you. My writing in the area of the 25th Amendment started with a predecessor book called From Failing Hands, The Story of Presidential Succession, and that was published in 1964, as I recall, and some years after the publication, we had to confront Watergate and the 25th Amendment. Was used several times during the Watergate scandal.
Indeed, it was. It seems almost as if it was written for Jerry Ford. But we'll get to that in just a minute. I'm curious. The presidential succession is one of those things that's definitely in the Constitution, at least since the 25th Amendment explicitly. But it's not a sort of subject that you typically will spend a lot of time on in law school. In fact, I suspect most constitutional law professors spend little or no time on it. So what prompted you to pick up this subject all those years ago?
When I was graduating from law school in 1961, I read an article that focused, I believe it was in the New York Law Journal, that focused on an issue that had not been solved since the founding of the country. What happens if a president becomes disabled? Who declares the president disabled? And almost concurrently with that, I had a college classmate who had a folder of clippings about the three disabilities, you might say, a heart attack, a stroke, an ileitis attack of President Eisenhower. And I read all of the clippings and decided that the subject was a very interesting one. And I was curious as to why there was a problem and why the problem couldn't be solved. So I embarked on research while practicing law in the early 60s. And it culminated in an article that was published a month before President Kennedy's assassination. And as a result of that, I was asked to assist the American Bar Association in connection with a conference it was going to have on the subject, and then spent many years working on the then proposed amendment, assisting the staffs of both houses of Congress, and doing some writing as well, and. At the time, I thought once it went into the Constitution in 1967 that I would sort of do other things while I practiced law. I had an interest in the Electoral College system. I did some writing on that. But the 25th Amendment dealing with succession kept coming back, you know, during the Watergate period.
And before then, we get there, and I don't want to make light of the tragedy of JFK's assassination,
right?
But that was remarkably good luck for you and your career in terms of timing. If you were going to write an article like that, doing it right before President Kennedy was assassinated, virtually guaranteed, it seems to me, that somebody would pay attention to this otherwise obscure issue.
At the time I was writing the article, and when it was published, it pretty much had almost totally faded from consciousness, and I sent reprints around, one of which went to Arthur Kroc of the New York Times, and I have a letter he sent me back in before Kennedy's assassination acknowledging the reprint and said the two of us seemed to be the only ones in the United States that had any interest in the subject at that point.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't think that was the case, because the Justice Department had to face up to it in 1961, and supporting an informal understanding between the president and vice president how to deal with an inability if it were to arise.
Okay. Well, now that we've got the story of how you got interested in this, now let's go back to the beginning, if we could. Didn't the original Constitution have anything to say about this?
Yes, and it was an important provision of the Constitution. It can be found in Article 2 and Section 1, Clause 6. And the succession provision, and it basically provided for gave Congress the power to enact a line of succession, and it had some words, and I'm quoting from it now: in case of the removal of the president from office, or of his death, resignation, or inability to discharge the powers and duties of the said office, the same shall devolve on the vice president. And then it goes on to make it clear that Congress can appoint an acting president were the president and vice president unable to serve in the position. But the problem was that clause of the Constitution was not explicit in who declared a president disabled.
That's a pretty important question.
Exactly. And what would happen in the case of a disability? Would the vice president become an acting president? Or would he take over the office of president for the rest of the term of the previous incumbent president?
That's an important distinction, isn't it, John? Because an acting president, you might expect, would serve very briefly and then would be replaced.
Exactly. And if you look at the second clause of the succession provision, it talks about an officer that's appointed by Congress in the line of succession shall act as president, and in the case of inability, does so until the disability be removed.
Right, and so that's pretty much it's a temporary position, and moreover, an acting president would not be expected to have the same level of power, or certainly the persuasive power that an actual president would have. So when was the first time that this issue became particularly important in our history?
In 1841, and in 1841, William Harrison died in office. He was in office for about a month, and his vice president, John Tyler, asserted that in a case of death, that he became president for the rest of the term. He took the he took the title of president, and he occupied the office of president. He said that's what the succession provision means. And some members of Congress, John Quincy Adams and others at the time, did not agree with that. They said that under the succession provision, you became acting president because if you didn't become acting president, that you took over the office and the title, we would have a problem in the case of disability, where a disabled president. Having been replaced by the vice president, would not be able to get his office back.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Tyler actually got away with it, though, didn't he? I mean, he established something called the Tyler precedent, right?
Correct. And he did so because the president had died, and there was no issue about a vacancy in the presidency for the rest of the term. And his assertion prevailed. But the latent ambiguities that I mentioned came back to be a problem later in our history.
Yeah. In Tyler's case, of course, since Harrison had died only a month into his term, I mean, that was a big issue. I mean, he was basically looking at either a very temporary position, with an election being held to replace him, or he was looking at the full 4 years, basically. So
right.
So he won that political struggle, and he established that precedent. But as you say, it didn't resolve the issue of disability, didn't resolve all the remaining issues. When was the next time that it became very important to us?
Well, others followed the precedent. When Lincoln was assassinated, his vice president became president for the rest of the term, following the precedent set by Tyler. But in 1881, Garfield was shot. He ultimately would die, I think it was 80 days later. But during that 80-day period, the issue of a possible successor as acting president emerged, and there was confusion about what would happen if Arthur, his vice president, took over during that 80-day period when he was essentially disabled and wavered between life and death. And because of the confusion created by the Tyler precedent, Arthur stayed away from any claim of being the acting president or the president for that matter. And the country had to deal with that at a different time in our history, 1881, compared with the present time.
But it was still about 3 months. And during that time, if I understand my history correctly, Garfield was lying in bed with a bullet in him and was really not able to discharge his duties at all. So we really didn't have much of a president during that time.
I think that's a fair statement.
Yeah. Well, so it's a big issue, but still nobody's going to solve it. I mean, were there attempts to solve it after Tyler or after Lincoln or after Garfield?
Well, we had the problem again when Woodrow Wilson had a stroke.
Yeah, that was a big one.
And it was an effort by the Secretary of State to have cabinet meetings. And when the president learned of that, he was fired. And his vice president stayed away from asserting that he should be serving as as the acting president during Wilson's inability. And these issues that were created by Tyler's precedent operated as a restraint on both the vice president and the cabinet supporting an acting president in the form of the vice president. And that came back again during the Eisenhower years.
A big thing, and I want to talk about that because you make some points in your article that most people don't even know about Eisenhower. They covered that up, too. We'll talk about that, but first we're going to take a break and have a constitutional quiz. It's your weekly constitutional. We're speaking with former dean of Fordham Law School, John Furyk, all about the 25th Amendment. Stick around. Now it's time for a constitutional quiz recorded live at the We the People State Finals held this year at the Darden School of Business at the University of Virginia, where there's also something called the Center for Politics. And the center has sent over Meg Hubeck to help with this week's constitutional quiz. We're also assisted by David Cash Earhart, the Director of Student Programs at the Sorensen Institute.
Cash, you have another attractive young lady as a contestant. Who is this contestant?
We've got another contestant. This is Olivia.
Olivia, where are you from?
I'm from Maggie Walker Governor's School.
Maggie Walker Governor's School. Olivia, you ready for Meg's question?
I think so.
I think we need a really tough one. I had Olivia in one of my sessions today, and she's pretty smart, so I think we need to do a hard one.
You're putting a lot of pressure on me.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I'm feeling a lot of stress.
I'm sorry.
I'm sweating.
I'm sorry.
Okay. All right, so see if we can do this. James Madison, writing as Publius in Federalist 10, speaks about the controlling the effects of... A, political parties. B, faction. C, lobbying. Or D, checks and balances. Think about that.
I don't know if the everybody heard that, but your classmates just told you you're on your own, Olivia. Okay.
It's B, factions.
B, factions. Wait a second. What were the choices again?
One, political parties.
Okay.
B, factions. Okay. C, lobbying. And D, checks and balances.
What about the first one? What about political parties? You don't think it's political parties? Don't you think that they have... You're no. Sure?
No. Is that your final answer?
Yes, B is my final answer.
Olivia, you're sure now?
Because we want to make sure our winning streak continues.
I'm very sure.
I can't get her off that answer.
But that's because it's correct.
All right.
Hey. He did, in fact, mention political parties, but political parties were just one of the factions.
That's a very good point.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week I'm speaking with John Furyk, who literally wrote the book on the 25th Amendment, which deals with the question of presidential succession, including the question of presidential disability. Wilson, it seems to me, is the quintessential example of this, because if I recall correctly, his stroke happened when he had a significant amount of time left in his term.
Right. And
they covered that up. And he was kind of half in and half out. And there were times when he could communicate and his wife claimed that she could communicate with him. But she'd go in the room and come back out and issue orders. And nobody knew if they were coming from Wilson or from his wife.
No, your history is absolutely correct. And very few people saw the president for what seemed like a very long time. There's some historians and scholars essentially say that for the 19 months that remained, I think it was 19 months that remained in his term, he was essentially unable to do what he normally would do as president before the stroke that he had.
Right. In fact, some people have even claimed that his wife, his second wife, I think her first name was Edith, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Was our first female president.
Yes, clearly she played a very significant role along with his doctor, and also had a Tumulty who was very close to the president, and historians would support what you've said.
Well, that's just extraordinary to me. We've had at least three circumstances then, four, that you've had presidents who have been dead or disabled for lengthy periods of time, in the case of both Garfield and especially Wilson, and yet still there's been no resolution of this in the Constitution itself.
Correct. And there was some effort at hearings at the time of, I think, around the early 1920s. And there was a lot of discussion about this and after Garfield died and 1881, 82, and Arthur, who became the president after he died, had a message to Congress suggesting that these issues be resolved. However, those efforts at reform didn't last very long, and nothing happened.
It's so interesting because it seems to me that these big structural issues with the Constitution. You know, how we govern ourselves, things like this, things like the Electoral College, which is a different issue, but similarly has to do with the way the government runs. People will get very concerned about them when there's a crisis, but then as soon as the crisis is over, it goes way off of everybody's radar screen.
I think that's right. Of course, the 25th Amendment was influenced in a significant way by the death of President Kennedy, which was a national tragedy. And
indeed, it was. But again, I interrupted you before. You were going to tell us about one more incident with Eisenhower in the 50s.
Right. So Eisenhower suffered three disabilities, and the people around him carried on the work of government. And in 1958, I believe it was, during his second term, he was so distressed by the fact that efforts that were made to have Congress deal with the subject faltered. And so he developed an informal understanding between him and his Vice President Nixon, which he believed was supported by the Constitution, and essentially his understanding said that he could transfer his powers and duties to the vice president and get him back as soon as he was able, and that if he was not able to declare his own disability, the vice president could declare his disability. And the letter of understanding suggested that the vice president should consult with appropriate people if he was going to declare the president disabled, and in that case as well, the president would get back his powers and duties as soon as he felt he was able. So that that letter agreement became really the first tangible protocol, you might say, in how to deal with this issue. And it was followed by President Kennedy with his Vice President Johnson, and it was followed by Johnson when he became president with the Speaker of the House of Representatives, John McCormick, who was next in line of succession when Johnson became president, leaving a vacancy in the vice presidency. If anything happened to Johnson, McCormick would become the acting president of the United States. But they had a similar understanding with respect to how to handle a case of disability.
Isn't it remarkable? These are just informal constitutional workarounds because we can't get ourselves together to amend the Constitution and take care of it. Before we leave the 1950s, though, entirely, I just recently learned for the first time that Winston Churchill suffered a disability during his second term as prime minister. He was, of course, out of office in 1946 and then 45, excuse me. after the Second World War, but then he came back in the early 50s, and it was during that second term in the early 50s, he suffered a stroke and was apparently out of it for a number of weeks as well. And there was a similar cover-up and a similar concerns in Britain. So this is something that can happen to any head of state, and it's an issue that really needs to be taken care of regardless of which country you're in. So that's when you enter the picture. You noticed all of this stuff about Eisenhower. You noticed that this had not been dealt with. And so you wrote your article. It faded into obscurity for only a few months. And then all of a sudden, the Kennedy assassination got you involved with the American Bar Association. So did I hear you correctly that you actually began the process of drafting this amendment?
No. What happened was a few things. President Kennedy dies on November 22nd, and Senator Birch Bayh of Indiana, who had taken over the Senate Subcommittee on Constitutional Amendments, introduces an amendment in Congress. No, it doesn't introduce it. Has a proposal he wants to introduce in Congress. And in that time period, in the time period being late December, January of January 64, the American Bar Association was influenced, I think, by its staff in no insignificant way to assemble a group of people to look at the letter agreements, look at the whole area of disability of a president. And I was told by one of those staff people that he saw my article, and he spoke to the president of the ABA and the president-elect. President-elect was Lewis Powell, later to be a Supreme Court justice, and thought was that I should be one of the 12 people they brought together, because I had written this article, which the staff person said to me seemed to be a very complete overview of the problem and a useful document for everybody to read.
And you were not even 30 years old yet.
That's right.
that must have been a heady experience.
Well, I was sort of shaken by the president's death. My generation, many of my generation, just were devastated by the president's death. Mm-hmm. And I was very happy to help out and share whatever I knew on the subject. You know, I had calls from the press, the CBS, ABC, and others for information on the subject. I sent everyone who asked a copy of my article. As I said, before the assassination, when it was a different world, so to speak. We had a very, very able president, young president, and this didn't seem to be the kind of subject that, we grab a lot of attention. And I suppose at the time, I expected my article to go on a shelf in a library, but I sent it around, encouraging people to do something about the problem.
Well, could you describe the process there with the ABA? Did you all actually come up with a draft of the 25th Amendment?
Well, what we did was, we issued a statement after 2 days. Senator Birch Bayh sat in on a lot of the meetings, and we had other members of Congress who came over for a while, and we issued a consensus statement that was not in statute and constitutional language. It was not a statute of recommendations that we thought should be reflected in the constitutional amendment. We had the benefit of Senator Birch Bayh's draft that was a very detailed kind of approach, and we supported the idea of a detail, and we added a concept that, in addition to detail, if the mechanism in the detail, that's to say the cabinet, did not work out in history, Congress would have the power to establish another body. And that's a provision you see in the amendments. And then, of course, we addressed the issue of a vacancy in the vice presidency, which had never been dealt with in the history of our country. and the group felt there should be there should be a formula for replacing the vice president if there's a vacancy.
Right.
So the ABA consensus statement reflected certainly in significant ways proposals that were in Congress. S.J. Res. 139, which was Senator Birch Bayh's document, and you could also say it picked up the concept of another body, which had been in other proposals in Congress. But so the thinking of the ABA, was consistent with a lot of ideas that were around, certainly. And but the great contribution the American Bar Association made, working with Senator Bayh and the leadership of the House of Representatives, was to empower lawyers all over the country to get involved in and supporting the ABA conference statement, which in a sense became part of the legislative proposals in Congress. Senator Bayh's proposal, which was the principal proposal, but there were aspects of the 25th Amendment that was not covered by the conference report. Which represented a contribution by the House of Representatives and representatives like Emanuel Sella and Richard Poth, in particular, of Virginia, who died a few years ago. Emanuel Sella, of course, is gone too. So it was you had both parties, very much contributing, to the amendment itself.
Do you think that all the tumult of the 60s and, of course, obviously the assassination of Kennedy, do you think it just added to a sense of crisis that, and all the other assassinations that were occurring, of course, Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King and all the other tumult, do you think that that's what kept this process moving forward, whereas it had never moved forward before?
I think Birch Bayh in particular, and the House leadership had hearings. And they had testimony from Eisenhower and Nixon. I had the honor to testify with Lewis Powell and the president of the ABA before on the Senate side. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of people that across the two-party lines that felt that this was the time for a consensus to that should take place, where you had the leaders of our country supporting it, and while there were different views still present, it started to really take off. And I was asked to chair a Young Lawyers Committee of the American Bar Association, and I also served on the more senior. I was a young lawyer, but I served on with some of the senior lawyers as well, And all over the country, the legal profession got involved.
Mm-hmm.
And in every state, communicating with the members of Congress to support the ABA consensus, ABA position. I thought the role of senior lawyers and young lawyers in every state in the country was an enormous help to Senator Bayh and Emanuel Sella in bringing together members of both parties in both houses of Congress.
I've often wondered whether the Cuban Missile Crisis and all of the popular concern about nuclear war is reflected in a lot of the books and movies of that era, things like the Failsafe and Dr. Strangelove and 7 Days in May, which was about a military coup in the United States. All of those tended to focus on the power of the presidency and how important it was in that modern time. Did that also push people forward and try to resolve this?
I would say certainly the idea nuclear weapons and a global war and the imperatives of having able leadership and no loss of continuity was absolutely an influence and important.
Yeah, I would think so. It's one thing for Garfield to be in bed for 3 months in 1881 It's a lot different to not have somebody at the helm even for a few hours in the 1960s. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is John Feerick, a professor of law at Fordham University, who knows all about the 25th Amendment, that part of the Constitution that tells us about presidential succession. After the break, we'll finish up our conversation with John Feerick. Stick around.
Out of them. It's true. I don't care. I don't care. We now have a gun on every table. We're ready to start shooting.
You know, you can see there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever.
New questions this week surrounding Donald Trump's temperament. What exactly makes a presidential candidate fit to lead?
Calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States. Until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
This president keeps telling untrue things, and he does it every single time. He's in front of the microphone. It's demonstrable. I can re-rack the tape for you.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people. I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that war.
Is Donald Trump mentally ill?
He's not a war hero. He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay?
You could always come up with a rationale as to why he's doing it. Like, it's effective. He knows he's trying to be, you know, a wrestling character.
I don't wear a toupee. It's my hair. I swear.
We have to talk about who's going to be the leader of the free world, and I don't think Donald Trump should be that leader.
I've said that if Ivanka weren't my daughter, perhaps I'd be dating her. You know?
You're running for president of the United States.
I didn't start it.
Okay, that's,
I didn't start it.
Sir, with all due respect, that's the argument of a five-year-old.
I didn't start it.
How could anyone in my party think that this clown is fit to be president?
And he referred to my hands. If they're small, something else must be small. I guarantee you there's no problem.
He doesn't give many answers to how he would solve problems. He sort of makes faces and says insulting things. I'm sick of him.
What, this worst Thanksgiving week since 2001, might we have to give thanks for? One thing, the 25th Amendment, Section 4.
Is it true that Republican colleagues of yours expressed concern about President Trump's mental health?
A few. It's not the majority of them, it's a few.
In what way?
In the way that we all have this suspicion that he lies a lot. 3 to 5 million people voted illegally. There was a new one about people going in from Massachusetts to New
Thousands and thousands in a bus. Yeah,
that is not the norm for a president of the United States, or actually for a human being.
People around him are refusing to work with him because of his behavior.
So I can be the most presidential person ever.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish our conversation with John Feerick, who's been telling us all about the remarkable and fascinating history of presidential succession in this country. Turns out there was quite a problem with it. The original Constitution really didn't address the issues nearly as specifically as we needed it to. And so John Feerick and a number of other people got together and put together something we call the 25th Amendment. So what eventually emerges, could you just describe what the 25th Amendment is and what it currently says that emerged
from
this process?
I'll try to make that short. It has a provision that allows the president to nominate, where there's a vacancy in the vice presidency, death, resignation, removal situation, a new vice president who has to be confirmed by both houses of Congress. That's the only place in the Constitution where the House of Representatives has a role in the you might say the appointment process.
Mm-hmm.
And so it deals with a gap in the Constitution that was there from the beginning, having to do with filling a vacancy in the vice presidency. And secondly, it deals with a disability of a president, and it makes clear that in the case of death, resignation, or removal, that's the title of president, that the successor, that is to say, the vice president, serves for the rest of the term, becomes president, serves for the rest of the term. And the first time that was to happen was when Gerald Ford became president when Nixon resigned from office. So that's the first, that's the first time that happened. Then there are two other provisions, Section 3 and 4 of the 25th Amendment, that deals with disability. It allows the president, who believes that he or she is unable to discharge the powers and duties of the office, because going in for surgery and going to be under general anesthesia, to pass over the powers and duties to the vice president, who becomes acting president. And as soon as the president feels he can reclaim his powers and duties, he's able again. He takes over the powers and duties again. There's no block on the president who declares himself disabled. Section 4 deals with a very difficult situation. It basically provides that if the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of the office, the vice president and the cabinet, majority of the cabinet, have the power to declare the president disabled, in which event the vice president becomes the acting president. And if the president subsequently believes that he's able to resume his powers and duties, he will do so, unless the vice president and the cabinet say, no, we don't think you're ready yet. And if the president disagrees with that, then Congress has 21 days to resolve the issue.
Yeah, you've covered several different possibilities, of course, starting with the vice president. It's always good to have one of those around. But certainly the Tyler precedent was confirmed. So death,
right,
disability, removal. We know we've got a president, not just an acting president. It's an interesting question if a president's going to take himself out. And in fact, that we'll talk about that in a moment. It's happened a couple of times. The most contentious one, of course, is the one you've identified, which is when a vice president determines that, oh, my gosh, the president is crazy, or the president is unable to discharge his duties but is unwilling to do anything about it, then the vice president can effectively, if he gets a majority of the cabinet to vote with him, can remove the president, at least temporarily. But then you've got that battle of the papers. The president can then reassert that he is capable, and if you've got the battle of the president and the vice president, then it has to go to Congress to be resolved.
Right, and during the interim period, the vice president would continue to act as president, because there had been a serious issue raised as the president's capacity, and it would take a two-thirds vote of both houses of Congress to deny the president the resumption of his powers and duties.
My. Well, I'm glad we haven't had to go through all of that yet, but we have gone through some of this. So this all gets ratified in 1967, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and then just in time, because in 68 we have the election of Richard Nixon, whom we've heard from before in this narrative, and he becomes the first president. Well, first of all, he has a vice president resign, and then he himself resigns. And so all of a sudden, this amendment that you guys have put together becomes the focus of government succession. So what happens? Spiro Agnew leaves first, right?
Agnew left in September of 73.
So he's the first vice president to resign, correct?
The second. John Calhoun, way back, resigned to run for the Senate. But he resigns, and the president, Nixon, nominates Gerald Ford to replace him.
Right.
And he's confirmed in roughly 2 months. And so he's become the new vice president. And then
Gerald Ford had been Speaker of the House. Excuse me, Minority Leader in the House, right?
Exactly, and very, very popular person in the Congress. So Birch Byers said that he thought he was the ideal person who, you know, to take over. I testified to that effect, and others did as well. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, 10 months later, Nixon resigns. At which point, Ford, the vice president, becomes president, and then he turns around and he nominates the governor of New York, Nelson Rockefeller, to be the new vice president.
Did you ever have any idea when you were participating in the drafting of this amendment that it would be utilized three times within basically one presidential administration?
Absolutely not. And to lose an elected vice president and the president was something that we had never experienced. At the, you know, in terms of the elected president and vice president, both leave and replaced by an appointed vice president and appointed and a president. But I was in a state of shock at the time about Watergate, and yet. Once Ford took over, of course, there was a controversy about the pardon that he gave to Nixon, mm-hmm. but there was stability.
Yeah, I remember that happening. I remember that happening, and I remember everybody heaving a great sigh of relief.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to testify along with others, and I think it was, I'm going to say 1975, the Senate had hearings to review the application of the amendment, and I remember being testified with Paul Freund of Harvard and Reedy, who had been the press secretary for Johnson, and all three of us gave testimony that ran along the same lines that the amendment worked and it contributed substantially to. The stability of the country at a very, very difficult time.
Well, once again, John, your timing was impeccable. You were the man there just in time for that circumstance. Has it not, now, that, of course, was the pinnacle, at least thus far, of the 25th Amendment's utility. Has it been used subsequently?
Yes. The first use of it was by President Reagan in 1985, when he had to go in for surgery, and he'd be unconscious during the surgery, and he sent the vice president, George Bush Sr., a letter that basically said that during the surgery, you're the acting president. Now, in the letter, it disclaimed that it was. It disclaimed the 25th Amendment, said that it was words to that effect. It didn't. Reagan later was to admit that it was the application of the 25th Amendment. I remember doing a television interview or two at the time, and he did everything you would expect the president to do, who's invoking Section 3 of the 25th Amendment. So that was really the first. It was a bumpy start. Mm-hmm. However, subsequent to that, you know, George Bush second, he used it twice, I believe, in 2002 and 2007, when he had to have surgery, and both times he passed over the powers and duties to the vice president. For the duration of the surgery, and then reclaimed them a few hours after the surgery, and his use of the amendment was something that one hoped might be the case, and when the amendment was adopted, that presidents would feel that they didn't have to hide their disability.
Right.
They could pass over the powers and duties to the vice president. So
that seems eminently reasonable to me. And in fact, I have to applaud President George W. Bush for having done that explicitly. In fact, it recalls an earlier circumstance involving President Reagan, where arguably the 25th Amendment should have been invoked. And that, of course, was his 1981 assassination attempt. attempt that was made upon him. And I recall vividly that there was some very serious concern about who was in charge. And then when the then Secretary of State, Alexander Haig, stepped forward and said in a very shaky voice, "I'm in charge here," well, a lot of people begged to differ.
Yes, well, he had it wrong. He hadn't focused on the line of succession, that after the vice president, it goes to the Speaker of the House, and then the President pro tem, and then the Secretary of State. I believed at the time that what he did was trying to calm the country, mm-hmm. but it created an issue with colleagues in the cabinet who had to remind him that what he said, that constitutionally he was next, was not accurate.
Yeah, I always actually felt a little bit bad for him. He got a lot of criticism, and the criticism was justified for the reasons you've just stated. On the other hand, he found himself at the White House. The president was in surgery and perhaps was going to die. The vice president was not available. In fact, I think the vice president, who was the first President Bush, was on a plane.
Exactly.
Trying to get to D.C. So who's in charge? Well, you want to calm the country. You want to say, don't worry, everything's under control. I'm in charge here. And in fact, he's a former military officer. I had the pleasure of meeting him one time right around this time. He's a military officer. He had been a general in the Vietnam War. He's a take charge kind of guy. He's going to calm everybody down, make sure everything's working. Only problem is that's not what the Constitution says.
Right, and it was the radio communication between the plane and the White House was also tortured, so that mm-hmm. there was not effective communication.
Well, I think we've pretty much covered the history of the 25th Amendment. Correct me if I'm wrong. Has it been invoked any other time?
No, it was considered on other occasions. It was considered by President Clinton when he was going to have a hospital procedure, but since it didn't involve general anesthesia, it decided that it was not the president didn't suggest he should do that, you know, and so he didn't invoke it. But the answer is no, it has not been invoked since 2007.
Well, before we leave, John Furyk of Fordham Law School, is there anything you'd care to add about the 25th Amendment?
No, it was an honor for me to have a role, and I remain still involved. I've been conducting a presidential succession clinic this school year, and next fall we will issue a number of studies having to do with gaps in the larger system of presidential succession, including the line of succession. But I think the 25th Amendment at its 50th anniversary has proven its importance in securing the safety of and stability of our country.
Well, John Furyk of Fordham Law School, thank you for the interview, and thank you for helping us through the Watergate era.
No, thank you very much, and I appreciate your interest in calling me, and I wish you and all of your all of those who are listening to the program a good year to come.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to John Furyk, the former dean of Fordham University Law School, now a professor there, who was so instrumental in the adoption of the 25th Amendment and who literally wrote the book on the subject. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. And before we go, a friendly reminder that we're not just a radio program, though we're very proud to be one. We're also a podcast, and you can find our podcast and our Facebook page and our Twitter account and all that good stuff simply by Googling our name. Your Weekly Constitutional. Three words, Your Weekly Constitutional, and I guarantee you, you're going to find lots of good stuff. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.